Our symposium today, Efforts to Decolonize Psychology Education, Reflections from the Australian Indigenous Psychology Education Project Community of Practice. It's a bit of a mouthful. My name's Joanna Alexi, and I'm joined here with Dr. Catherine Orr from the Swinburne University of Technology Psychology Department, and we'll be co-chairing the session today. And so we'll just do very brief introductions so you know who we are. So just very briefly, I have Cypriot heritage. I grew up in Larrakia country, Darwin, and moved to Noongar country as a teenager, where I've lived, worked ever since. And I work in Professor Pat Dudgeon's APEP team, so the Australian Indigenous Psychology Education Project, as a research fellow on her team alongside Pat and Belle Selkirk and also Chantel, who's just started working with Pat as well. Unfortunately, Pat and Belle couldn't make it today, so I'm representing APEP on their behalf.
Thank you, Jo. So I'm Catherine. My family of origin are settler Australians with a really wild mix of Western European heritages. I was born on Bunurong country, which is in the southeast of the state we know as Victoria today. I've lived on Wurundjeri country and on the land of the Abenaki people in America as well for 5 years. When I moved back to this country 5 years ago, I resettled on Bunurong land, and I feel incredibly privileged to be raising my family in that beautiful part of the world. And I'm very, very grateful to elders past and present and to emerging leaders in that community who've been so welcoming and supportive.
Thanks for that beautiful introduction. So we want to start off the session first and foremost by acknowledging country. So acknowledging the Muwinina peoples as the traditional custodians of this land, and the Palawa peoples for their continuing culture, strength and resilience, and for keeping this land so beautiful for millennia. Also really wanting to acknowledge Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples joining us today, and anyone that's joining us online as well. Thanks so much for joining. And so we're just really thrilled, actually, that you can join us for this session. And we do have a collection of learnings and knowledges that will be shared to you by community of practice members of the Australian Indigenous Psychology Education Project. And so I'll just give a little bit of context about APEP in case you're not familiar with it, but potentially you've all heard of it before. But APEP is a groundbreaking Indigenous-led project led by Professor Pat Dudgeon and her team. And there's been a couple of iterations. The first iteration occurred in 2013, and we'll talk a little bit about that in Geneva's presentation. And the second iteration of APEP began in 2020, and it was revitalised through the Transforming Indigenous Mental Health and Wellbeing Project. And it sits within stream two of that grant there. And really the aim of APEP is to work towards decolonizing psychology education and to better supporting Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander psychology students towards a more equitable society where Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples are receiving culturally responsive and safe care free of racism. And so that's the context of APEP. And in this second iteration, a really big part of APEP is the community of practice. And so the context around that is, you know, you would know that in 2019, APAC changed their standards and included a cultural responsiveness standard. And so a lot of educators have been looking for support. So that community of practice really brings together a range of expertise to better support educators to make those changes. And so that's the context of the community of practice, really. And I'm just going to pass to Catherine, who's going to talk a little bit about how this symposium came about and a bit of the structure for today, and then we'll jump into the presentations.
So the symposium came about because Jessica suggested that we present on a decolonizing the curriculum project that we'd undertaken at Swinburne. And we really felt it's impossible to present that as a standalone project. The way that we undertook that work was so embedded with the work of APEP and the work of the community of practice, their support, their leadership, the resources that they've provided, the support that they provide, that really putting together a symposium that showcases not only the range of projects and the range of resources that are available through APEP and the community of practice, but also the real spirit of collaboration and learning together and support. And Geneva talked this morning about learning through error, that real support that you get through trying and failing and really demystifying, I think, a lot of the process that we go through when we're trying something new and learning something new. And so we really wanted to put together a symposium. We approached APEP, and Belle Selkirk was an amazing leader and advocate. She provided Aboriginal oversight and approval for all the work that's being presented here today and for the symposium. And so for that, we're incredibly grateful. Oh, and the structure, sorry. So we're about to wrap up. There'll be four talks. The final talks being presented by Associate Professor Geneva Ohan and Joe on their work on the annexure that provides really concrete, useful support around how to implement Standard 3.8.
All right, so without further ado, we're going to get into the presentations. So really pleased to announce and introduce Miss Emily Darnett. So Emily is a proud Palawa woman raised on Yugambeh country who resides in Nam. She is currently undertaking a Doctor of Philosophy in Clinical Psychology and will be presenting some of her research here today. Her PhD as a whole investigates how the psychology field can promote social and emotional well-being with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander clients through education and practice. Outside of her studies, Emily holds several positions across universities, contributing to decolonizing research and education to improve outcomes with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities. And today, Emily will be speaking to us about her excellent research, Psychologist Perspectives, Decolonizing Psychological Practice and Curriculum.
Hi, everybody. I'd like to start by acknowledging the Muwinina peoples of the as the traditional custodians of this land. I acknowledge the Palawa people as the continuing carers of the land, the sea, the waterways, and the sky, as well as culture. We're very lucky to be gathering here today. I'd like to pay my respects to elders past and present and any other Aboriginal people in this room. I'd also like to acknowledge the historic and continued hardship that Aboriginal and Torres Strait people experience within the educational system. I'd acknowledge the shifting and political social environment that we actually find ourselves in, with the hope of it moving towards decolonization across all systems. I'm a very proud Aboriginal woman myself. I am from, I'm a Palawa actually. Unfortunately, given the historic wrongdoings that happened down here, I am unaware of my specific mob in which I belong, but it's very nice to be back a bit closer. You definitely feel something a bit different when you touch down. I also have ancestral ties to the United Kingdom and Germany. I'm a PhD candidate, as you heard, and just shy of a decade being in the tertiary education system. I play several different roles in this. I'm a student, I am a staff member, I'm a researcher, I'm a lecturer as well as a tutor. So I've also done universities across four different universities in three different states. So we're talking about lived experience, I've got it. So I just want to provide a bit of a rationale as to why I undertook my research before actually telling you what the research is. So the Closing the Gap report is continuing, and I'm sure this is, you can click, no surprise, no new information to anybody. You can see up here that we are meeting targets for children enrolled in preschool, as well as people employed, which is great to be meeting targets. We're improving but behind target for year 12 equivalent people completing tertiary education and people engaged fully in employment or education programs. And the gap's actually widening for the developmentally readiness for children at school, which is, I'm sure we can all understand the ongoing impacts that that'll have as kids continue through their education. So this is the Australian Universities Accord interim report with the overall recommendation made that the need in Australia to establish a high quality and equitable higher education system is right now. So out of the five priorities, four of them, the first 1 to 4, address equity, specifically First Nations aspects as well. So you can see that this report has just been released, and at the end of this year, the full report will be released with their recommendations. So this specific priority I want to highlight is First Nations at the heart of Australia's higher education system. It highlights a few different of the further considerations of the accord. And I think there's considering penalizing financial penalties for institutes that don't comply with the consideration to increase First Nations students and support available to us, which is a really big step forward, I think, and hopefully might start to create some change. So on an international level, you can see that on the left, the APS definition of Indigenous psychology. It recognises Indigenous psychology and intellectual movement across the globe based on these suggested factors around colonisation, making a stance against colonisation. So these are across the globe. So the kind of things that we're going to be impacting by making the small changes here in Australia and in each individual university are actually having a worldly impact. And then on the right, you can see the UNISECO have identified sustainable developmental goals, which form a program of sustainable, universal, and ambitious development. And so many of the elements of education fall into these kinds of aspects because we know with education we can impact poverty. And then number four is just education in general. So many of the accessibility of getting First Nations people into education systems will actually help improve this as well as Indigenous worldwide. So the aim is to investigate how tertiary education can be decolonized. By providing psychology students with a better understanding of Indigenous historical and cultural and social experiences and practices, we're likely to improve their ability and confidence to promote social and emotional well-being when working with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander clients. To explore this, we asked the main stakeholders of universities, the students as well as the past students, about what they think can be done to be improved, and reflecting upon their education, what kind of happened for them, what did they experience, how much exposure to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander content did they receive. So this was as part of a bigger study contributing towards my PhD thesis. So we did survey 115 psychologists, and a lot of that's looking at best practice. All participants were set into three different conditions dependent on how they responded to a few questions. Indigenous psychologists were one, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander psychologists were one condition. The next condition was non-Indigenous psychologists that have worked with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples before. And then the last condition, which is the one that you're seeing the results of, was non-Indigenous psychologists or provisional psychologists that have not worked with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people before. So we took more of an educational approach to this cohort to try and understand how they're feeling about potentially working with us for the first time. So the participants was 20 people. The age range is right, so it was 23 years old to 60 years old was our oldest person in this category, which is quite surprising given that it seems unlikely that a person has got to 60 years of being a psychologist or 60 years of age without engaging with an Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander client. So a quarter of them were born outside of Australia and two of them were registered overseas first. That's where they completed their initial tertiary education. The majority of participants are located in Victoria because that's currently where I am, so it's not surprising, with two of them in the ACT and two from Queensland, and then one worked across Victoria and South Australia. 18 were located in metropolitan areas, one was regional, and one worked across both locations, and 11 were provisional psychs, five were clinically registered, three were just registered, and then one was a counselling psych endorsed in that area. So to collect the data, we took, it was just a 20-minute mixed method Qualtrics survey disseminated as far and wide as I possibly could imagine. So it was to a lot of organisations. I emailed every single head of school at all of the universities across Australia to try and get them to disseminate it onto their students that met the eligibility, which was just holding a minimum of a provisional registration with APRA. So the APS Hive actually turned out to be the most fruitful place to advertise, which is really helpful. My numbers went up quite quick, shows good interest in this area. So the findings. So we asked, during your education, do you feel you and your peers were provided with enough education to adequately adjust your psychological practice to work with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander clients? 89% said no. they said things like, it just felt like it was an add-on. Two lectures over 4 years, not many practical suggestions, no education, and then one lecture on it. And obviously, there may have been more than they remember, but it's obviously not made a lasting impact for these people. So I think we've got to be doing better. 11% said yes, because they seem to be, they have a psychologist, they get access to a psychologist as a lecturer with working experience in the Kimberley. So maybe drawing a lot on their experiences, which is really helpful for that person to think that they're getting enough knowledge from this person. So maybe that's something that we can look into, is making sure that we have Indigenous staff members at university that do have contact with students. And another person said that they're only 6 months into their masters and they've already had a two-day cultural immersion program, which is really amazing. Definitely something I want to find out more about. But I think the aspect of this I want to focus on is that people were saying that I don't feel comfortable or confident working with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, which is kind of not surprising when we're reflecting on the rationale that I provided and why there might be such a big gap experienced for us. So the next question is, what information would you find useful to guide your psychological practice with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander clients? So four themes emerged through lived experience, education, practice, exercised, and intervention guidelines. So people were suggesting things like wanting to interact with mob, get more access to people with lived experience. They were saying that they want to know more about the historical events that we've experienced and how that might be impacting us now, as well as some of our cultural norms and understanding the self-determinants as well. We had practice exercise, so they want to be able to know how to apply a social emotional wellbeing framework to a case study. Want to know what terminology that they should be using, as well as learning to critically reflect and build an awareness of their bias that they may be having. The last one was intervention guidelines, which was just learning which westernized tools are appropriate, how to adapt the westernized interventions to be more culturally appropriate, and how to decolonize their thinking so that they can work reflexively with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people inside like the rooms. So when asked if they have any apprehensions about working with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, 87% said yes. Of the people who said yes, two themes emerged. One was that they feel like they have a lack of knowledge. So people said things like, I have a limited understanding, I'm not confident, I know that there's knowledge that I'm missing, and I have a lack of experience and training. Theme two, perpetuating harm. People are aware of the aspects that we have experienced historically, and they're scared to inadvertently re-traumatize by just lack of knowledge. Next, we asked, do you feel if you have enough cultural knowledge about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander culture to safely and successfully provide psychological support to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander clients? 31% said no, 63% said unsure, and only 6% said yes. And then we asked if they have any specific questions. And I think this is a really good starting point for people that are not sure of where they can go or how to make a start. They see the problem, but like, what do you do about it? Going off these questions, there's things like we can do, just like circulating the terminology guide, giving them resources to our favorite websites that we use, guiding them on how to find an appropriate supervisor, signing them up for the APEP newsletter, because they're always circulating some really great resources and all the articles that they're publishing. Making sure that we're educating staff, because they're the ones that are disseminating and translating the information. They're the ones that are on the front line. They're the ones that can change the education that they are providing to have a bit more of a decolonized theme, or even just maybe an Indigenous framework here and there. Make sure that we're adequately resourcing our staff as well, because they need to undertake the trainings and the understanding. And if they're not paid to do it, there's so much burden on them already. We don't want to add anything else. So it has to be adequately resourced. So last, the next steps is that I have to actually finish writing this paper. Then I have another paper presentation at AARE conference in Melbourne, and it'll be submitted to that journal, which is amazing. Translating the finding to the APEP community of practice to see their input. Taking findings back to the Swinburne Indigenous Psychology Committee to explore how we can use them to further decolonize the psychological education, tertiary education that we are providing there. And I think to build upon these as well is to collect and embed Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander current and past students' perspectives, because of the way that the study was designed, there's actually no Indigenous voices in this. So it is ultimately excluding mob. So that is definitely not something that I want to do. So I think I'm going to go back and build upon this and maybe do a Aboriginal perspective on this one. And my other thesis studies are also elaborating on this and exploring Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people's stories about engaging with psychologists and psychological services and what they think that students need to know to be better.
Thank you so much, Emily. I'm full of questions, but we are going to hold questions till the end, because I'm thrilled to be able to introduce Professor Nicholson Perry, who will be talking on changing disciplinary and institutional cultures, a case study. So for Catherine's background, after a career in clinical psychology in the UK and in Australia, Catherine became a psychology academic, first at Western Sydney University and then at the Australian College of Applied Professions, including a role leading the professional psychology programs and then later the discipline of psychological science. Catherine is now the Associate Dean of Learning and Teaching, a role which gives her ample opportunity to explore and harness the power of education in delivering social justice.
Thank you so much. Hello, everybody. It's lovely to be here today. And thank you so much for being the official slide advancer, Joe. I appreciate your effort. I'd like to start out as well with an acknowledgement of country, in particular, obviously acknowledging the Muwinina people, who are the traditional owners of the lands on which we're meeting here today, but also the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, which is where I live and work in Old Sydney Town. But Tasmania plays an important role for me, I guess, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that. But I think it was a place that I visited with my family about 20 years ago now, and it kind of brought home to me some of what I was lacking in my knowledge around Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples and history in this country. And I didn't kind of really realize it at the time, but I think it had quite a significant impact on me at the time and was part of a journey that I'm kind of reflecting on, if you like, as part of this case study. And I hope it will all come together and make sense as we go. So I'd just like to start out with thanks, because I'm reflecting on changes that have happened in the college that I work in, but those changes come about as part of influences and interactions and collaborations. And there are a number of people who have influenced that and organizations as well. In particular, I'd just like to acknowledge Tracy Jackson, who a couple of years ago, we finally managed to secure funds to have a paid First Nations representative at the college, which is a private higher ed provider. And so everything we do has to be paid for by student fees. We don't get kind of block funding. First Nations students in our institution aren't able to access some of the supports that they can in public universities, for example. You know, making the argument and getting a paid position was really important. And Tracy really relished the opportunity. And then again, this is another one of these kind of turning points, I guess, when she very sadly died suddenly. She was a couple of years older than me. And again, just it brought to life what we know about the impacts of colonization on mortality and morbidity amongst many, many colonized people. So I just wanted to reflect on that, but also all of those other people who are listed up there who have been helpful, I think, to us at ACAP. Some of you may have picked up my accent. I was born and brought up in the UK. This is a photograph of my hometown, Plymouth. And this is marks what's called the Mayflower Steps in Plymouth, which was the place where the Mayflower ship left the UK on its way to America to colonize the US. And so I moved here 20 years ago, having grown up in a town that was you know, intimately connected to the colonial activities of the country that I was born in. And so I left there as a clinical psychologist who had trained in a very conservative institution in a very conservative country. 20 years ago, I mean, it doesn't sound like very long ago, I think attitudes have changed a lot, but in many ways they haven't also. I was really unaware of all of those kind of assumptions that I was carrying at the point that I left the UK and arrived in Sydney. When I came to Sydney, I guess I came with a number of beliefs that my training had given me around what psychology was there to do and what psychologists were there to do, and that we were there to treat sick individuals. And over time, working mainly in the kind of rehab sector, I started to think about how important it was that we actually needed to focus on the systems that end up creating this sickness. And that connects, as you might imagine, to reflections on colonialization and the impact that it has had on Indigenous peoples across the world. But I think one of the things that struck me was actually how little the Australian people that I came across seemed to know about the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who had been here on these lands for such a long time. And I was shocked and surprised by that, and I continue to be shocked and surprised by that. When it came to 2019, when the revised APAC standards came out, at that point I was head of psych science at ACAP, and we were going into reaccreditation of our courses in 2020, and any of my colleagues from the time who were in the room, it's fine if you start twitching. It was not a great time, 2020, to try and, you know, reorganize all of your courses. But there were some things in those accreditation standards that, as a collective working in the school at the time, we had to really seriously think about how we were going to address. So that included the reference to trying to provide a better education in cultural awareness and responsiveness in higher education and the training of psych workforce, and to increase the number of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander students in the psychology workforce, and also to produce graduates of even foundational courses who are reflexive, culturally appropriate, and sensitive to the diversity of individuals. And this was a long way from what I saw in our courses at the time, where, if you like, we would start at the bottom with all of the foundational information that was about the sort of traditional science of psychology, which positioned us as being observers of occurrences in the environment, and not having an active part in that, and not bringing any of our own biases. And so we seem to have embedded into the way that we did things the idea that we could then, you know, we would teach that which was true for everybody and generalizable to everybody. And then towards the end of the course, we'd have one little unit that was called, I can't even remember what it was called now, intercultural and Indigenous psychology, I think. So, you know, we would just hold that lens and try and pretend that people weren't operating with a lens that they had already developed as a result of just living in a particular culture. And then we would teach them this whole new body of information and then just drop this little penny in at the very end and expect them to do something useful with it. And so our approach was to kind of turn things the other way around, if you like, and start with that lens instead. And so we actually worked with a number of other courses around the college, so our counselling and criminology and social work courses, and we put together three different common core first year units, which tried to reveal, I guess, the lenses that we all bring in to our course of study, to reveal our disciplines as something that have a culture to them, and that these are all things that if we can learn about them at the beginning and then bring that as a critical kind of frame for reflecting on everything that we see and we get taught from that point, then hopefully our students will leave at the end of their degree with a better understanding of themselves, their own position in relation to the discipline they're learning. And also critically, we put quite a large amount of content around Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, but also using materials that allowed students to apply their knowledge in the context of thinking about some of those sort of social questions. So, and I've rattled through this, but I guess some of the things that we learned going through that was that we needed to understand that it was our responsibility to go and inform ourselves, to make up for some of the gaps in our historical knowledge, for example. Nobody else can do that except you. And we asked a lot of the educators who were working in the school at the time in terms of being willing to participate in doing that. So it's our responsibility to think about that as well as individuals, and how, what do we need to know, and how do we need to get there and be willing to put the time and the effort into addressing those things. It's also important to tell our students that it's their responsibility too. And this goes back to a conversation that I heard earlier on today, I think, about, you know, students struggling with the idea of the effort that you have to do to learn. Well, you really have to be prepared to be critical about a lot of the things that you may have learned and come to believe just by growing up in the culture that you grow up in. But it's their responsibility to do it if they wish to graduate with some of the courses that we teach. Oh, we've also really learned that it's not just a question of teaching content, it's also the way you go about it, and that our students are not a clean slate around this stuff when they come in. They have pre-existing ideas, and you have to help people understand what those pre-existing ideas are and then strip them back and rebuild them again. And that one of the difficulties for us is that a lot of us have been brought up, well, certainly, you know, I'm in my mid-50s, have been brought up in an education system that viewed me as the norm and everything else as, well, not entirely, because I'm gay too, and I'm a woman, so I'm not, you know, but anyway, I'm pretty much the norm and everything else as being different. And finally, that, and something else I've already heard today, is that learning includes making mistakes. We've got to be, we can't say, well, we might get it wrong, which goes back to what some of your participants were saying. We can't use the risk of getting it wrong as an excuse for not doing anything. We are in a very, very privileged position, and we need to take that seriously. All you can do is do the work so that if you do make a mistake, you've done it well. You've asked the right people, you've done the right preparation, you make the mistake not because you're careless, but because you took a risk, and then you have to make them count in terms of what you learn from them.
Thank you so much, Catherine, for your excellent presentation. So our third presentation today is from the brilliant team at Swinburne University of Technology, Psychology Department, and involved in that work were Drs. Catherine Orr, Jessica McElprang, Justin Trusson, Emily Darnett, April Goodring, Jordan Gibbs, Eli Karmas, Poo Chen, and Monica Thelking. And today, Jessica is representing the team. So Jessica was born on Pauchi country in the US and now lives and works on the lands of the Wurundjeri and Boonwurrung people of the Kulin Nations in Victoria, where she is a senior lecturer and clinical psychologist at Swinburne University of Technology. She teaches on topics related to health trauma, grief, and loss, and is an associate editor for Clinical Psychologist. Today, Jessica will be presenting on an initiative to co-design decolonized content in a fourth-year psychology course.
Hello, everyone. It's such a pleasure to be here this afternoon to speak on behalf of this wonderful team of colleagues and students who contributed to the work of striving toward co-designing some of our content in our fourth-year units. Emily mentioned that this is her first oral presentation. This is my first presentation holding a small human. So hopefully we can both hold it together and get through this. Now, thank you for your patience as I navigate professional womanhood and motherhood. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the Muwinina people, who are the traditional owners of these lands. I feel very privileged to be able to be on this country to discuss this topic and feel very connected to the waterways of Tasmania for a number of reasons. I'd also like to acknowledge the Palawa people and pay my respects to elders past, present, and emerging, and express my gratitude for their care of the seas, skies, and land. I'd also like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, where Swinburne's campuses are built and where I have the privilege of working. So today, I'm going to tell you a bit about a practical example of some work that we did at Swinburne to try to strive toward decolonizing and indigenizing some of the content in an on-campus honors course and our online graduate diploma advanced. So this is a combination of work of Swinburne University of Technology and Swinburne Online. And I say striving because I don't think that there's necessarily an endpoint. I think it's a process, and we're learning and trying to find momentum in this work. And I hope that we can offer you some ideas for things that you might consider as you approach this week, this work yourself. Now, as psychologists, we all have a responsibility to reflect on the historical harms that have been perpetrated as a result of our profession and the harm that continue to be done by assessment and intervention practices that are not done in culturally safe ways. But it's not enough to reflect, we need to act. And as educators, that action is as important as ever. So when we think about decolonizing, it's not just about trying to decolonize the work, but also about honoring paradigms that are based on Indigenous knowledges. Now, we know that there are a number of things that might be barriers, institutional and individual factors that get in the way of decolonizing and that can be barriers and things that hold up, obstacles that we encounter. And one of those is that non-Indigenous academics may lack confidence and capability to approach this work and be afraid of inadvertently perpetuating institutional racism, which is something that Emily touched on. We also know that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander academics have described racialized power imbalances, and that there's really a burden placed on these colleagues to do and be all things in this work. And so as we thought about moving into trialing a process to indigenize some of the content in these courses, we wanted to both figure out a way to reduce some of the burden on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander colleagues and students, and to also increase capability among non-Indigenous staff in our department, myself included. So to give you an idea of how our course is structured, in addition to the thesis units, there are four units that comprise our fourth year. There's an ethics unit, a quant methods unit, and then there are counseling and interventions and a psych assessment unit. And it's those latter two units that we chose to target in this initial process. So to give you a sense of some of the institutional context that we have, which are really some things that were sort of in our favor that helped to set the stage for this work, were a great support from our department head, Professor Monica Thielke, and the dean of our school. They really wanted to see us find momentum in this space and to support the work that we were trying to do. We also have a committee in our department called the Swinburne Indigenous Psychology Committee, and we meet regularly to work toward discussing how can we upskill staff in the department, what are we doing to create safe learning spaces for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander students who might be interested in our courses or who matriculate into the courses, and how can we just try to do better collectively and share learning. We also have a history of engaging with the Mundani Tumbadal Center, which is the heart of all Indigenous matters at Swinburne. And a number of the members of our team have been involved with the APEP community of practice, which is just an incredible resource and community for learning. We approached this process with a bit of a two-way learning way of being that was described by Nakatas, as sort of learning systems coming together at a cultural interface, if you will. And we really wanted to prioritize that shared learning and to move towards some sort of institutional reform, if you will, in the way that curricula is developed within our department. We wanted to co-design with Indigenous knowledge holders, try to, again, reduce that burden on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander colleagues and students, and to work toward making sure that we were meeting the needs of our students and our discipline to the best of our ability. So the approach that we took was first to lead with core values of justice and self-determination. We didn't want to sugarcoat what psychology has or has not done. We wanted students to enter these units with the foundation of what have some of the problems been and how do we move forward. And we wanted to make sure that any resources or topics that were integrated were supported by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander colleagues, the individuals as part of our team who we termed Aboriginal expert partners for this, these purposes. And again, centering the co-design approach. So I'm going to walk you through a little bit of this timeline of how things unfolded, which took place in 21 and 22. So first there was the formulation of this idea to approach this process that was led by Professor Monica Teal King, and she secured institutional support at the school level, which involved something very important, money, to compensate the folks who were involved and willing to give their time and knowledge to this process. And this included a combination of members of our team. There were five Aboriginal individuals involved, one of whom is a clinical psychologist, three amazing postgraduate students and one honors student. And then there were four non-Indigenous academics, myself and Dr. Catherine Orr were among them. We then selected those units, as I mentioned, and the initial curriculum development process was undertaken by Dr. Orr and myself. And we went through the process of trying to walk through each of those two units week by week, see what was included, what were the readings, what were the resources, what were the topics, and to consider where we might weave in additional content. We would then come back together collectively as a team with the Aboriginal expert partners and say, this is what we've tried. This is what we're thinking in terms of what we might bring in. These are the resources. What are we missing? What don't we have right? What sounds like, you know, what have we completely overlooked or what are we missing? And sought critique and feedback on those. And that became an iterative process of those various elements. And then finally, we launched those units. And in choosing elements to bring in and resources, we really wanted to foreground Aboriginal ways of knowing, being, and doing, and increase students' awareness of the strengths and the resilience of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, and hopefully to increase some of their awareness of ongoing issues of racism, and I mean, ultimately, hopefully to be more responsive and safe and be more culturally, have more cultural humility in their approach to psychological practice and their learning. So this, I can kind of describe it in a few words, but as I mentioned, you know, Catherine and I combing through week by week, all the different elements, basically creating some very big, messy, unwieldy spreadsheets that we then tried to refine into something palatable, and just really trying to do our best to be thorough. And this resulted in a variety of changes to each of those units, and numerous new materials being brought in. And we really wanted those to be woven throughout. So you'll see an example here of a page where we linked in a cultural safety framework into, this is a snippet of Canvas, and we tried to build in opportunities for reflective exercises. We know students are not vessels in which we can just pour information in. We wanted them to find ways to engage with material in ways that got them thinking about how they think, what their reactions are, etc., and build those in throughout. And now we have just a brief video. This is Catherine walking through an initial kind of foundation setting for one of those units.
When working with the panel of experts, it became clear that a shared goal was to make sure that the experiences of traditional custodians and that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander ways of knowing, being, and doing were really embedded into the content rather than being presented as a standalone module. To make sure that we're providing appropriate context for these lessons and activities that we really wanted to feel organically part of each unit, we make sure that at the outset we really discuss the importance of these activities for achieving APAC Level 2 competencies and for students to be able to demonstrate cultural responsiveness, including with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures, when they're applying the specific material that's being taught and learned in each unit. All of Swinburne units have week zero activities and readings that students complete during orientation week. So along with information about lectures and assignments, the students in our programs read an acknowledgement of country. We want to make sure that the students have a shared understanding of the importance of an acknowledgement and why doing an acknowledgement is consistent with our values as psychologists. So in addition to providing that explanation and that education, we also provide resources for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander students and any students who want to learn more. We also have a link to an Indigenous Cultural Competency Unit, which is designed by the Mundani Turtle Centre. So in the unit psychological assessment, we orient students to the harms that have been done and continue to be done by conducting assessments and using tools that are not culturally safe. So we discuss the APS apology in this context and the commitment in that apology to attitudes and actions that are characterised by cultural responsiveness and safety, and how their work in this program is really in part progress towards meeting those commitments.
So this work, I think, inevitably is messy but joyful when it's shared. And it really was that. I mean, I certainly went into each of those meetings, you know, nervous and a bit uncomfortable, wondering what we hadn't gotten quite right. But I think that's important that we hold space for that as we go through this and do our best. And so I hope that what this kind of shows is sort of perhaps in a way, an iterative way to go through this work, that you don't have to do everything all at once. You don't have to get it all right the first time. But if you take the time to build relationships, create safety within teams to share that learning, it helps to facilitate it. And that incremental change is change. And we all have a responsibility to make a start and to do our best. So thank you very much. A couple of other acknowledgements. Some of the resources that were useful for us, and then just final, just thank you for your time this afternoon.
All right, and so we're at the fourth presentation now, and it's my enormous pleasure to reintroduce Joe and to introduce for the first time in this symposium, but I think like the fourth or fifth time today, Associate Professor Geneva Ohan. They are going to be presenting on cultural responsiveness, the Annexure to APAC Evidence Guide on Standard 3, Criterion 3.8. Associate Professor Ohan, Geneva comes from Canada but has lived on Noongar land for over a decade, where she's an associate professor and she directs the cultural psychology programs at UWA. However, for this talk, she is representing APAC's Cultural Responsiveness Working Party. Jo introduced herself before, but just as a refresher, she has Cypriot heritage and she lives and works on Noongar Budja in Western Australia. She's a research fellow in Professor Dudgeon's Transforming Indigenous Mental Health and Wellbeing Project and the Australian Indigenous Psychology Education Project. For this presentation, she is also representing APAC's Cultural Responsiveness Working Party.
So I'd like to start off by acknowledging country and acknowledging the Muwinina and Palawa peoples of this land and paying respects to their elders past, present and future. So today we'll be talking on behalf of the APAC Cultural Responsiveness Working Party about clarification that we developed to support higher education providers in Australia to meet Criterion 3.8, Standard 3, which states that cultural responsiveness, including with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures, is appropriately integrated within the program and clearly articulated as a required learning outcome. And the annexure document is available online. So if you haven't had a chance to read it yet, please do go and have a look. There's a QR code. There's a QR code there. So please have a read if you haven't. And so today in this talk, just a bit of an outline for the talk today, we'll be giving a little bit of the background and context to the annexure document and what had happened beforehand to lead up to the development of this document. And then Geneva will provide an overview of the annexure document, as well as how educators are currently using the annexure. So just to give you some very brief information and context around the education landscape before Criterion 3.x, I think that helps to center where we were at and where we ended up. So before Criterion 3.8, cultural responsiveness and Indigenous knowledges in psychology wasn't included as a learning area, and you've heard that throughout the talks. And the impact of this was quite negative on both Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander students, as well as non-Indigenous students as well. So for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander students, there were a lot of westernised knowledges and not many Indigenous knowledges presented in the curriculum, but anything that was sort of presented was often from that colonial standpoint. So it was very difficult to translate content into one's own cultural context. And for non-Indigenous students, they found it really hard to actually go out into the workforce and feel confident to work with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples in a culturally safe way, which is so important. So APEP, the first iteration, was actually funded to address that underrepresentation of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples in psychology, as well as the lack of knowledges that were presented in the curriculum. That first iteration occurred from 2013 to 2016, and you heard from me speak about that before. The project was led by Professor Pat Dudgeon. And there were a number of frameworks and guidelines that were developed from that first iteration, including the curriculum framework, which was centered around the core knowledges that are important to include within psychology curriculum, as well as a student and workforce framework, which was around supporting the retention and recruitment and graduation of students, as well as current workforce capabilities. Importantly, APAC was a co-signatory to this, all three documents actually, and also received backing from a number of national psychology bodies. So in recognizing the need to increase graduate skills in cultural responsiveness, and through that foundational work of APEP, APAC developed Criterion 3.8, and that was included in the 2019 accreditation standards. The intention behind Criterion 3.8 is to firstly prioritise First Nations culture and identity. So wherever we stand in Australia, we are on Aboriginal land, and it was about recognising Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples as the first peoples of this country. And within Criterion 3.8, those definitions were articulated through an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander perspective, and also knowing that it can be applied to other cultures and contexts, as well as defining culture in that broader sense than ethnicity. So when we're thinking of culture, it's all of the intersectionalities of culture, such as gender identity and age, just a couple of examples. We recognised that the interconnection between cultural responsiveness, cultural awareness, cultural humility, cultural safety, and reflexivity are all linked to one's lifelong journey. And I will just briefly mention as well the process to setting up the Cultural Responsiveness Working Party and then hand over to Geneva. But really this came about because higher education providers, after that 2019 standard was released, were really after some more clarification around the intention behind the criterion, and just needed a little bit more information around how they could begin to apply this in their own school contexts. So APAC appointed a working party, which are the authors of this document, and that's listed in the document if you do want to have a look. And it was developed over a number of months, I think 18 months to be exact. It was a really iterative and collaborative process, and it had significant partnership with IEPA, the Australian Indigenous Psychologists Association, APEP, HODSPA, and educators, as well as APAC assessors. So it had the full breadth of experience and expertise working on this document in a collaborative and iterative way. After national consultations that were targeted in 2022, and this occurred over a number of months with a number of stakeholders, the annexure was accepted by the APAC board and published earlier this year. So with that context, I'm going to hand over to Geneva, who's going to talk you through the sections of the annexure document. Thanks, Geneva.
I am going to talk you through the annexure. Now, I imagine everybody here has read through the annexure back to front a number of times, so this will be just a little bit of reminding. But for those of you who haven't brought it with you today, you can use a scan here to connect the QR code to the document. Joe's done that for us kindly. I'm going to right now just walk you through each section and give you an overview of each, starting with section one, which is where we unpack the Criterion 3.8. And again, Criterion 3.8 is cultural responsiveness, including with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures, is appropriately integrated within the program and clearly articulated as a required learning outcome. Really, the intent here is to expand and clarify the intention of Standard 3, Criterion 3.8, and to show that what we're interested in is having graduates from our programs across Australia who respect and value cultural awareness and responsiveness and have skills to respond in culturally appropriate ways in whichever place in Australia they tend to go off to work, which can be in many different places. It also goes on to have another section, and I should mention as well that that is prioritized from a First Nations culture and identity lens. It goes on to also provide definitions through an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander lens as to what cultural responsiveness, cultural awareness, cultural humility, cultural safety, and critical reflexivity are in one's lifelong journey in cultural responsiveness. In section two, we outline evidentiary requirements that providers can consider. In particular, it's set up in two sections. The first one is about how cultural responsiveness can be appropriately integrated within the program. And so there we link in, there's a nice figure in there. I think it's a beautiful one, thanks to the amazing graphical artists at APAC. Wouldn't be able to do that myself. We talk about all five domains or all five standards and how we can and need to do better than we are than by just linking into content. We need to integrate this perspective into all five domains. And we go through and explicate what that means from an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander lens. I'll give you an example. You might say, right, so what do you mean about the student experience? And we expand that to say, well, equity and diversity principles promote and support recruitment, admission, and completion of the program by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. At UWA, we introduced an honors entry pathway 3 years ago. And this past year, we introduced a postgraduate entry pathway. And if you haven't already done so in your programs, in a different role that I hold, not as part of my APAC kind of identity right now with you today. I just finished co-chairing with Stacey McMullen at the University of Newcastle, a document on guidance towards instantiating equity pathways for honors and for postgraduate entry. And I would be thrilled to tell you all about that later. Send me off an email and I'll even send it to you or send the link to you. That's a nice plug there. Section two goes on then to say, right, and then how can we clearly articulate as a required learning outcome cultural responsiveness? Okay, well, we provide some examples as to how this might be done. Nothing is prescriptive, it's all by exemplar. Okay, so giving ideas and inspiration as to how you might do this. Now, as we know, cultural responsiveness is a journey. It's not a tick box. It's not somewhere that we aspire to necessarily be in this little center of a definition. It is something that we are forever becoming. And so our students are going to come in and be at different levels of competency. And as they go throughout the program, we are going to require them to engage in increasingly complex tasks throughout their training. We're going to, in particular, ask them to go from knowledge or knowing through to being and then into action. Okay, and those are increasingly complex tasks. And so in this other beautiful picture or graphic, which I again can claim absolutely, no, this was not my feat. We have this outlined. So what do we mean by increasingly complex? Well, level one being undergrad, we start out with comprehension and reflexivity. So it's primarily a knowing task. And then we go through some more being things like integration and reflexivity and into doing practice and reflexivity. And then by fourth level, the area of endorsed programs like clinical psychology, clinical neuropsychology, we now see knowing and doing and being, okay, so advanced model of practice and reflexivity within the area of endorsement. All right, so for example, you might say, what's the difference between level three and level four in particular in terms of complexity? I'll give you an example of what I do. I teach into the Master of Clinical Psychology programs, which I also direct at UWA. And at level three, I ask students a question about self-reflexivity and say, right, describe the power that you're going to have as a student therapist the first time that you walk into the room with somebody who is from another culture. Tell me about that. And then in level four, once they've been out and they're practicing and they've been in the health department and they're starting to see in private practice and all these other places and they're practicing and seeing how this is playing out, I say, right, So now I want you to tell me that you've experienced this in clinical psychology, and you've seen this in settings. Describe to me how you've experienced this. What's gone right? What's gone wrong? What will you do differently in future? How can you talk about this with others and have them engage in that task? So that's an example there. And you might say, well, Geneva, that's just two examples. And I'll say, oh boy, have I got the annexure for you. Because we go through and take one stimulus, the APS apology, which is an amazing stimulus. If you haven't read through it recently, I really think you should. It inspires me and I read through it regularly. And we take that one stimulus and go through all the levels, what might be the different tasks. And we do that, as I said, at each level. Unfortunately, I don't have time to read through every single one for you, but it's in the annexure document. Here's one at level two. An example learning outcome at level two is identify how the APS apology relates to research, and an example assessment task of explain why human research ethics applications have requirements around special populations, including but not limited to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. All right, section three, you're almost done with me, but not quite yet. We give examples of supporting evidence. In here, we went through HODSPA, we being the APAC Cultural Responsiveness Working Party, we went to HODSPA and said, right, can anybody help us out with actual real life examples? As my kids would say, IRL, Mom, can we get some IRL examples of how universities are doing this, or tertiary education providers, I should say, are doing this? And we had some really great responses, which was quite heartening to see. And so we could only feature some of those, but we tried to look at ones from across different areas. So spoiler alert, they're not all about clinical psychology, though some of them are, like one of mine is in there. And we look at mapping those against the the 12 APEP pedagogical principles. And we chose that because we thought when we're looking for developing curriculum, having a curriculum framework that is based in an Indigenous governed policy or document that provides us with a way of thinking about what we need to cover, well, what better can we do than that? And we looked at this framework and it was just amazing as to the 12 principles. We couldn't do better than this. This is great stuff. And so we linked it in there. We got permission from the APEP staff who developed that document. If you don't have the curriculum framework on you, I'm sure you do somewhere, but if you don't have it on you, you can scan your QR code there to download that. And so we go through each of these examples that we've provided from the IRL examples, so to speak. We go through each and link it into here. We link it into the APEP pedagogical principles and show some extra clarification that might be sought by an APAC assessor about that example that's provided. I should note that the people who provided us with examples, we did not ask them to do this. This was something that we applied later. And we do say in the document that we think this is a good idea for you to do, but you're not required to do it as a provider when going through accreditation at this point anyhow. All right, now you really are almost done with me. I'm going to give you just two examples of universities who have used the annexure and what have they had to say to us about using this annexure. Liz Pritchard, who's the director of the Industrial Organizational Program at UWA, provided me with some examples. She said that the interconnectedness is a figure on the interconnectedness between cultural awareness, humility, responsiveness, and reflexivity provided in the glossary of terms section. And she shows the definitions and the picture to her students, and they talk about the uniqueness and the overlap between these terms and how they can be applied in IO practice. She also looks at using this framework and linking it back to the National Practice Standards for Mental Health Workforce and the APS Code of Ethics to do a few things, as you can see here, including but not limited to encouraging students to identify and commit to continuous development. And then what she does on the basis of that has a good idea as to where each student is at in their learning and takes that into workshops and into supervision, fills in any gaps, and tries to continue developing. A second example here from kindly provided by Megan Kilcullen at James Cook Uni. The context here is that they were having some challenges with meeting this criterion 3.8, and they found that the strength of the annexure was that it clearly made Indigenous knowledges and experiences central to the curriculum. And so in revising and making responses, they then could help, that then helped them to give a framework around what they could do. In particular, they also found that explaining that cultural reflexivity is a key, an opening to cultural responsiveness. Without reflexivity, we can't have responsiveness, finding that that was very helpful to them in terms of making them reflexivity one of the first things that needs to happen. And they've now embedded that into all of their assessments. So there'll be an aspect of cultural reflexivity there. So many thanks to her in providing that example and that guidance. And she said, look, across all subjects, contents and assessment requires students to reflect upon questions of who has voice, who is silenced, when considering, for example, the development of psychology modalities and assessment instruments. And they've embedded social, cultural, and political context into the subject, and the impact of racism, discrimination, and social policies that impact the health and well-being of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders Australians. These aren't topics that we've always taught in psychology, but there are topics that we need to teach in psychology. That is it from me now. Thanks very much for your attention.
Thanks so much, Geneva, for that excellent presentation.